Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're diving deep into a relationship forged over millennia in Mesopotamia, Anatolia, and the Zagros Mountains, the story of the Kurdish and Assyrian peoples.
Yeah, these are two of the most ancient indigenous groups in, well, an incredibly complex part of the world.
And what's really fascinating is how their histories are so deeply intertwined. It's not simple.
Not at all. You see these amazing periods of, you know, coexistence, cultural exchange, even alliances. But then right alongside that, you have these really intense chapters of conflict.
Exactly. And that's what we want to unpack today. Both communities have navigated empires, modern borders that cut right through their lands, and sadly, they share this long, painful history of marginalization.
So our goal here is to trace this relationship, right? From the very beginning, those ancient roots, all the way up to what's happening right now.
We'll hit those key historical moments, especially the devastating impact of the 20th century genocides, and then really look at the current dynamics in Iraqi Kurdistan and northeast Syria.
And looking at their interactions, it really gives you a powerful lens, doesn't it, for understanding these broader themes.
Like what specifically?
Well, minority politics, for one, the patterns of ethno-national conflict, which are sadly still so relevant, and just the fundamental, often agonizing challenges of trying to coexist peacefully in such a volatile region.
Absolutely. We'll explore the factors that have shaped things.
Yeah.
Geography, obviously just being neighbors,
mm-hmm.
but also overlapping claims to land, those interesting differences in how they live, like nomadic versus settled agricultural life.
Right, the socioeconomic structures. And religion, of course, has played a huge part. Predominantly Muslim Kurds, predominantly Christian Assyrians.
And you can't ignore how their relationships were constantly influenced by whoever was in charge, the ruling powers.
And a pattern really does seem to emerge when you look closely. Periods where the state was weak or, you know, collapsed, that often led to violence, unfortunately.
A power vacuum situation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then, maybe surprisingly, sometimes shared oppression actually pushed them together, forged cooperation.
So to get the full picture, we've pulled together a really wide range of sources. We're talking academic research, historical texts, archaeological finds,
NGO reports from people on the ground, news archives, official statements, and importantly, voices from within the Kurdish and Assyrian communities themselves. We've tried to get multiple angles.
Yeah, build that layered understanding. So our journey today is chronological. We'll start with ancient roots, medieval encounters.
Then into the Ottoman period leading up to the SIFO, the Assyrian genocide during World War I.
After that, we'll look at the post-Ottoman chaos, life under Ba'athism in Iraq and Syria.
And finally, bring it right up to date with Iraqi Kurdistan and northeast Syria. The aim is to spot those recurring patterns if we can.
Okay, let's dig into those ancient roots. Upper Mesopotamia, the Zagros, Anatolia, basically, a cradle of civilization.
Truly one of the earliest places where people settled down, started farming. We're talking way back.
Like Göbekli Tepe, Halinçemi, Abu Huraira, 9000 BC. It's mind-boggling.
It really is. And they were neighbors even then. Raises questions about early interactions.
That proximity is key. Now, jumping forward quite a bit, the term Kurdistan, that doesn't really pop up clearly until the Middle Ages, right?
Right, used by geographers then for areas with Kurdish populations, mostly Zagros. But Upper Mesopotamia, that fertile area, that was the Assyrian breadbasket sustaining their empires much earlier.
And even back then, maybe mid-third millennium BC, in ancient Kurdistan, as some call it, the precursors to both groups were interacting.
Yeah.
Often clashing with powers to the south.
Yeah, and that pressure from the south, from powerful Mesopotamian states, it seems like it pushed them to organize more politically, socially, involved ancestors of both Kurds and Assyrians.
Think Ninevite V culture.
Exactly, and later the Hurrians, the Mitanni Empire, they all shaped this landscape.
Now, Assyrian civilization, Assur, Nineveh, that's incredibly well-documented history. But the term Kurd appears much later, 7th century A.D., Islamic conquests, often meaning nomadic groups initially.
It highlights a difference in the records, doesn't it? Assyrians have this deep written history. Kurds emerge more distinctly as a socio-political group later, especially during that Kurdish interlude, 10th, 11th centuries, with their own principalities.
And then you see Kurdish populations expanding into Mesopotamia, Anatolia, often with the Seljuks, the Mongols, settling lands, sometimes as military rewards.
And you get those famous Kurdish dynasties, like the Ayyubid Saladin, of course, and later principalities documented in things like the Sharafnama or even Marco Polo mentioning them near Mosul.
Which brings us to Assyrian continuity, Is there a direct line from ancient Assyrians to modern communities? It's debated.
It is, but research like Hermes Abunas is pretty compelling. He points to early sources, Western travelers, missionaries.
What did they find?
They found people already identifying as descendants of ancient Assyrians before the Arab conquests. That self-identification was already there.
So that distinct ethno-religious identity held strong, anchored in Christianity, Church of the East, Syriac Orthodox, Chaldean Catholic.
Exactly. Their faith was a key marker, and even their names for themselves, Sulush, Suraya, linguistically linked back to the ancient Atreju. It's powerful.
Plus, the autonomy of the church in Hakkari until the 19th century shows that persistence.
Absolutely.
Okay, so piecing together their early relationship sounds tricky. Limited, unbiased sources.
Very tricky. You have later Kurdish narratives emphasizing shared origins, maybe common ancestry. But earlier sources, like some Armenian ones, often point more towards conflict, competition.
Why the difference?
Probably reflects changing power dynamics. And think about their lifestyles, nomadic pastoralist Kurds versus settled agricultural Assyrians. That alone could cause friction over land, water.
Abuna mentions conflict over grazing rights specifically.
Yes. And scholars like Adance suggest Kurdish expansion sometimes involved violence against settled populations, likely including Assyrians. We see records of raids, especially when central power, like the Abbasids, weakened.
But it wasn't all conflict, surely. There must have been coexistence, alliances.
Oh, definitely. That example of Assyrian tribes in the Hakkari Emirate having clanship rights is fascinating. Exemption from tribute, a role in governance, providing fighters. It suggests mutual recognition, shared interests.
So it's complex, varied by time, place, local powers, bigger empires.
Precisely. Not a simple story at all.
Okay, fast forward to the Ottoman era. After 1514, both homelands are part of this huge empire. How did that change things?
Well, the Ottomans had the millet system, giving religious communities some self-governance. But for Assyrian Christians, it seems it was less formalized than for, say, Greek Orthodox or Armenians.
Right. And initially, the Ottomans let Kurdish emirates keep a lot of autonomy, especially on the borders, kind of buffer zones.
Exactly. And that decentralization early on allowed for local coexistence, though, you know, still punctuated by rivalries.
But then comes this big shift. 18th, 19th centuries, centralization, the Tanzimat reforms, the Ottomans want more direct control.
And that directly challenged the autonomy both Kurdish emirs and independent Assyrian tribes, especially in Hakkari under the Marshman Patriarch, had enjoyed. Weak central power let them flourish before. Now it meant confrontation.
Which sets the stage for the horrific Beydir Khan massacres in the 1840s targeting Hakkari Assyrians.
Yeah, Beydir Khan Beg, the Kurdish emir of Botan, launched brutal campaigns against tribes like the Tiari. Reportedly instigated partly by Nur Allah Beg of Hakkari, it disrupted whatever coexistence existed there.
The scale was immense, wasn't it?
Tragically so. Tens of thousands killed, according to sources. Enslavement, villages, and churches destroyed. A massive trauma.
And there's this really disturbing angle of Ottoman complicity, or at least letting it happen.
Absolutely. Evidence suggests the Ottoman governor of Mosul might have authorized it, or at least looked away. From the central government's view, weakening independent Assyrian tribes might have seemed, well, useful for their centralizing goals.
A cold strategic calculation.
Possibly. They eventually moved against Beydir Khan in 1847, but only after the Assyrian tribal structure was devastated. It was a real turning point, shattering coexistence and foreshadowing worse to come.
Then, late 19th century, Sultan Abdulhamid II creates the Hamidiye Alaylara Hamidian regiments. Kurdish tribes, armed by the state, given impunity.
A profoundly destabilizing move. These regiments became notorious for brutality, not just against Armenians and Assyrians, but rival Kurds too. Heavily involved in the 1890s anti-Armenian massacres, land grabbing from Assyrians, with the state doing little.
So it empowered loyalist Kurds, deepened divisions within Kurdish society, and made Christians even more vulnerable.
Exactly. It poisoned relations right before World War I. And it shows that recurring state tactic, using ethnic dynamics for control, contributing directly to the conditions for genocide.
Which brings us to World War I and the rise of the CUP, the Young Turks. This created the conditions for destroying Ottoman Christian minorities.
Yes. The CUP's nationalist ideology, one nation, one religion, was key. They saw Christians as internal enemies, potential allies of rivals like Russia. The war gave them the pretext and the cover.
And the declaration of jihad just fueled the flames.
Absolutely.
For Syrians, this period is known as Seyfo.
Right. Seyfo means sword in Aramaic, reflects the weapon used. But the term historically meant extermination for centuries within the community.
Today, Assyrian genocide is widely used. There's some academic debate, maybe due to fragmented identities back then, but it fits modern definitions of genocide.
Overwhelmingly, yes. The scale, the systematic nature, it clearly constitutes genocide under modern international law.
And it unfolded across their heartlands. Urmia in Iran, Hakkari, Zvan, Bitlis, Diyarbakir, Turabdin, Mardin, even into modern Iraq and Syria.
A vast geographical scope. Things really intensified, became systematic in 1915 after earlier localized attacks.
Can you walk us through the stages? Early on, October 1914.
Attacks in border villages near Persia for refusing conscription. Talat Pasha's deportation order for Hakkari Assyrians came early, October 1914. David Gaunt sees this as the start of Seyfo, though mass deportation was hard then. But arrests, killings, irregular attacks happened. Reprisals after towns changed hands between Russians and Ottomans made it worse.
Then Urmia, Persia, early 1915, under Ottoman occupation.
Commanders like Cevdet Bey, Halil Bey, widespread massacres, troops aided by local collaborators whipped up by jihadist propaganda. The Haftavan massacre near Salmas in March 1915, over 700 Armenian and Assyrian men killed. A horrific example.
And then Hakkari itself, summer 1915.
A coordinated military assault. Ottoman army from Mosul under Haydar Bey plus local Kurdish tribes. The Assyrian tribes, led by Patriarch Marshimun Benyamin, had declared war on the Ottomans in May, trying to resist.
But they were outnumbered.
Heavily and outgunned. Promised Russian aid never really came. They were forced into the mountains, faced starvation, then that terrible exodus into Persia in August-September 1915. Ethnic cleansing, leaving their homeland empty.
And the genocide spread west, too. Diyarbakir, Sirte.
Yes. June-September 1915. In Diyarbakir province, Governor Mehmed Rashid Bey, known for his anti-Christian hate, orchestrated massacres of the Syriac Orthodox. In Sirte, Chaldean Catholic villages attacked by General Halil Bey's troops. They used death squads. Some Kurdish tribes, like the Raman near Batman, previously outlaws, amnestied by Rashid Bey to help participated. Eyewitness accounts from Turabdin detail executions, villages destroyed.
So the perpetrators were?
Primarily the Ottoman state, directed by the CUP Talat Enver, provincial governors, military commanders, the regular army, gendarmerie, the special organization, Tishkalata Masusa, death squads. Ottoman archives confirmed direct state involvement.
And the role of Kurdish groups? It's complex.
Very complex. Sources mention Kurdish tribes, militias, irregulars participating alongside Ottomans in massacres, looting, abduction in Hakkari, Urmia, Diyarbakir, Sirte, Turabdin. Some Assyrian accounts see Kurds as primary perpetrators alongside Turks.
But not all Kurds.
Definitely not. Other Kurdish groups and individuals protected Assyrians, sometimes at great risk. Yazidis in Sinjar sheltered fleeing Armenians and Assyrians. So it was state orchestrated, but implemented with varied local actors. Some Kurds acted under orders, some opportunistically, some out of local dynamics, while others resisted or protected victims. We have to be careful not to assign collective blame without nuance.
And some Kurdish figures have acknowledged and apologized more recently.
Yes, some intellectuals and leaders have made statements acknowledging the role some Kurds played.
Assyrians didn't just passively accept this, though. There was resistance.
Absolutely. The Hakkari tribes fought back. The defense of Azak is another example. And many Assyrians joined allied forces, Russian, then British, hoping for protection, maybe autonomy.
And oral histories are crucial here.
Immensely important, especially given the destruction of records and communities.
So you have these different narratives. Assyrian focus on genocide, loss, betrayal, trauma, demands for recognition. Kurdish perspectives are less documented, but likely mixed acknowledgement, denial, reconciliation efforts, and official Turkish denial.
And growing academic recognition of Seyfo as part of the broader Ottoman genocide against Christians, using Ottoman archives, survivor accounts, acknowledging the state's central role, but also the complex local dynamics, including Kurdish participation.
The immediate consequences were catastrophic.
Utterly. Mass death, a huge refugee crisis, think Bakbak camps in Iraq, permanent loss of ancestral lands, property, destruction of cultural heritage, deep, deep intergenerational trauma. It changed everything, irrevocably altered demographics, and fundamentally reshaped Kurdish-Assyrian relations forever.
So the Ottoman Empire collapses, but self-determination doesn't really happen for Kurds and Assyrians, does it?
Tragically, no. the Allies, Britain and France, carved up the Middle East for their own interests, Sykes-Picot, San Remo. Kurdish and Assyrian homelands got split across Turkey, Iraq, Syria, Iran.
Creating new borders, new conflicts we still see today.
Exactly.
The Treaty of Sevres in 1920 offered a brief hope.
A flicker. It proposed Kurdish autonomy in eastern Anatolia, maybe independence later, and an independent Armenia, which clashed with some Kurdish claims and might have pushed some Kurds towards Ataturk's nationalists who rejected Sevres entirely.
And Sevres was never ratified anyway.
Right. The Turkish nationalists won, and the Treaty of Lausanne in 1923 replaced it.
Lausanne established modern Turkey's borders and scrapped the autonomy ideas.
Completely. It had articles, 37 to 44, supposedly protecting non-Muslim minorities, but the Kemalists applied them only to Greeks, Armenians, Jews. Assyrians were deliberately excluded from basic minority rights, language, schools.
And Kurds, as Muslims, were totally excluded, facing assimilation.
Yes, Lausanne meant statelessness, vulnerability for many Kurds and Assyrians across these new borders. Some argue it basically rubber-stamped the results of the genocide by solidifying the new demographics and creating a legal vacuum for more marginalization.
Then there's the Mosul Vilayet issue. Diverse place Kurds, Assyrians, Turkmen, Yazidis, Arabs, fought over by Britain for Iraq and Turkey.
Big fight. Oil was a factor, too. It went to the League of Nations. Assyrian leaders petitioned hard they wanted Hakkari back from Turkey or an autonomous Assyrian region in Mosul, citing allied promises from the war.
What did the League decide?
In 1925, the Commission recommended giving Mosul to Iraq, but with conditions. Strong minority rights guarantees, especially for Assyrians, including local autonomy, and keeping the British mandate for 25 years. Turkey reluctantly agreed in 1926.
But the Assyrian autonomy promises, they didn't really happen.
Largely unfulfilled, a huge disappointment for Assyrians, and when Iraq became independent in 1932, it pledged to protect minorities, but those pledges were broken very quickly.
The British mandate period in Iraq, 1920-1932, sounds like a real minefield for Assyrian-Kurdish relations, too.
Yeah.
The Iraq levies.
Right. The levies became mostly Assyrian after 1921. They were effective for the British keeping order, guarding borders, even suppressing some Kurdish uprisings.
A symbiotic but difficult relationship. British needed them. Assyrians hoped for British support for autonomy.
Exactly. But their role as essentially agents of British power created huge resentment among Iraqi Arab nationalists and Kurds. This British policy of using one minority against others sowed deep divisions, making Assyrians incredibly vulnerable when the mandate ended.
As independence neared in the early 30s, Assyrian anxiety grew.
Massively. Petitions for autonomy went nowhere. In 32, levy officers wanted discharge to gather in northern Iraq to press their case. Alarmed everyone.
Then that tragic incident in July 33.
About 800 armed Assyrians crossed into Syria, hoping the French would let them resettle. They were turned back. This gave the Iraqi government Hikmet Suleiman, Iraqi Kurdish General Bakr Sidki, the pretext for a final solution to the Assyrian problem.
Which led to the Semli massacre.
August 1933, the Iraqi army under Bakr Sidki massacred around 3,000 unarmed Assyrian civilians in Semli and nearby areas. Women, children, some sources say up to 6,000. The British didn't intervene.
A defining trauma, recognized as genocide by scholars.
Yes. Led to another wave of displacement, many fled to the Khabur River Valley in Syria, showed the failure of international guarantees and the deadly legacy of mandate politics.
But in Syria, under the French, Kurdish refugees from Turkey got citizenship initially.
Yes, somewhat different situation early on. The first Syrian republic established, though France kept control, Assyrian refugees arrived after Semele. The Assyrian Democratic Organization, ADO, formed in 57, partly responding to pan-Arabism.
Kurds faced specific discrimination later in Syria, like the 62 census stripping citizenship.
Exactly. A huge number rendered stateless. But early on, Assyrians in Syria faced more general constraints, not that kind of targeted ethno-national discrimination.
And back in Turkey and Iran, more consolidation suppression.
Turkey clamped down on Kurdish identity, crushed revolts like Dersim. Assyrians faced assimilation, later got caught in the PKK conflict. Iran suppressed Kurdish leaders like Semko, crushed the Mahabad Republic in 46. Across the board, the post-Ottoman states solidified borders, divided communities, and centralized power.
Okay, moving into the Ba'athist era in Iraq and Syria, roughly 1960s to 2003 in Iraq, a particularly repressive time for many minorities.
Definitely. Ba'athism, rooted in pan-Arab nationalism, aimed for strong, centralized secular states. But in practice, it often meant dominance by one group, Sunni Arabs in Iraq, Alawites in Syria, and suppression via the Mukhabara, the security services, and one-party rule.
In Iraq, under the Ba'ath, the relationship with Kurds was marked by cycles of conflict and fragile deals.
Yes. The first Iraqi-Kurdish war started in 61 under Mustafa Barzani, KDP, after hopes faded post-58 revolution. Ba'athists continued the conflict. The 1970 autonomy agreement looked good on paper.
But collapsed over Kirkuk.
Primarily, yes. Led to the second Iraqi-Kurdish war, 74-75, ended badly for Kurds when Iran cut support via the Algiers agreement. Then the PUK formed under Jalal Talabani, splitting from KDP, continuing a lower-level fight.
And alongside the conflict, the Ba'athists pushed Arabization.
Systematically, especially after 75, aimed at changing the demographics up north. Forced expulsion of hundreds of thousands, Kurds, Assyrians, Turkmen, Yazidis, especially from Kirkuk. Villages destroyed, land confiscated. Arabs incentivized to move in.
The Iran-Iraq War, 1980-88, gave Kurdish parties a chance to fight back, often with Iranian help.
It did. But the Iraqi state's response was unbelievably brutal, culminating in the Anfal campaign in 88, led by Chemical Ali.
Genocidal intent.
Clearly. Aimed to wipe out Kurdish resistance and rural populations. Ground attacks, bombing, over 4,000 villages destroyed, mass deportations, firing squads, chemical weapons, Halabja being the most infamous, but many others too. Estimates range from 50,000 to over 182,000 killed, mostly civilians. They even used Kurdish collaborators, the Jash.
While Anfal targeted Kurds primarily, Assyrians suffered too.
Yes. Absolutely. Over 30 Assyrian villages destroyed during Anfal. They faced displacement, destruction, persecution throughout the Ba'ath era, those 1972 laws giving Syriac cultural rights, rarely implemented.
And the Assyrian Democratic Movement, ADM, founded in 79, faced crackdowns.
Severe crackdowns. Over 150 members arrested in 84 alone. Imprisonment, torture, four leaders executed for treason.
But despite historical tensions, this shared brutal repression led to significant cooperation between Kurdish and Assyrian opposition groups in Iraq.
It really did. Assyrians supported the 61 Kurdish uprising. The ADM took up arms in 82, defending Assyrian villages and fighting alongside the Peshmerga against the regime. They joined the Iraqi Kurdistan Front, IKF. Thousands of Assyrians joined militias fighting Saddam.
What drove that cooperation?
Shared marginalization, common goals, democracy, minority rights, sometimes shared secular or leftist ideas, plus international lobbying by groups like the Assyrian Universal Alliance, AUA, supported the Kurdish cause while pushing for Assyrian interests.
Turning to Syria under the Ba'ath, 1963-2011 focus, similar Arab nationalism but different specifics.
Yes, Hafez al-Assad consolidated power in 70. While repressive, the primary target for specific ethno-national discrimination was the Kurdish population.
That infamous 1962 census in Jazeera.
Egregious. Arbitrarily stripped maybe 120,000 Kurds, 20% of Syrian Kurds, of citizenship. Made them stateless. Ajani or Maktoumin. No basic rights, voting, property, jobs, services, passports, legal marriage. Inherited statelessness.
Plus suppression of Kurdish language, culture, political activity.
Systematically. Banning education, names, publications, changing place names, harsh treatment of activists, especially after the 2004 Qamishli riots.
How did Assyrians, often called Syriacs in Syria, fare comparatively?
Differently. They faced general political repression like other opposition. The ADO faced bans, arrests, but they weren't targeted by that same specific systemic ethno-national discrimination as Kurds, no equivalent to the 62 census.
The Ba'athist regime tolerated Assyrian religious cultural practice more, within limits?
Generally, yes, within churches and communities. So this differential treatment, overt suppression of Kurds versus general repression of Assyrians, probably explains why there's less documented history of joint Kurdish-Assyrian opposition within Syria compared to Iraq during that time. Both suffered, but differently, influencing their paths before 2011.
Okay, let's shift to the contemporary landscape, post-2003. The fall of Saddam Hussein changed everything in Iraq, especially for the Kurdish region.
Fundamentally, formal recognition of the Kurdistan Regional Government, KRG, as a federal entity, building on the de facto autonomy since 91.
KDP and PUK consolidated power, mostly sharing it, though they fought internally in the 90s. This brought Kurdish autonomy, but also new challenges for minorities like Assyrians.
Yes. Unprecedented Kurdish influence, but a mixed bag for Assyrians. While the KRG constitution recognizes minority rights, the reality on the ground is controversial.
Let's talk political representation. The quota system in the Iraqi and KRG parliaments. How did that work for Assyrians?
Initially, the KRG parliament had 5 Christian seats, Assyrian, Chaldean, Syriac, Armenian after 92, later expanded to 11 minority seats total, 5 Turkmen, 5 Chaldean, Syriac, Assyrian, 1 Armenian.
But has it been effective or legitimate?
That's the huge controversy. Assyrian parties, activists, observers consistently say the dominant Kurdish parties, KDP and PUK, manipulated it, used their resources to get Kurdish voters to back affiliated minority candidates.
So ensuring loyalists rather than independent voices.
That's the accusation. The electoral law allowed anyone to vote for quota candidates. So many elected minority reps are seen as KDP-PUK proxies, not really fighting for minority concerns.
And this blew up recently, February 2024.
Yeah, Iraq's federal Supreme Court ruled the 11 KRG minority quota seats unconstitutional, abolished them.
Who brought the lawsuit?
PUK members and an affiliated Christian party. But a coalition of 6 Assyrian, Chaldean, Syriac parties blamed both KDP and PUK for exploiting the system, leading to this outcome. They called it political and social genocide, removing guaranteed representation.
So making it almost impossible for them to win seats now.
Exactly. Veteran Syrian politician Yonodom Kana, ADM, announced a boycott of future KRG elections without a quota. It highlights deep flaws in minority participation in the KRG.
What about security? In the KRG and disputed territories, it sounds complex. Peshmerga, divided KDP-PUK, Iraqi army, local forces.
Very fragmented. After ISIS rose in 2014 and the Iraqi army crumbled, Peshmerga moved into disputed areas like the Nineveh Plain.
Assyrians felt the KRG failed to protect them. Reports of being disarmed, then Peshmerga withdrawing.
Yes, that perception was widespread. So Assyrians formed their own local security forces. Key ones are the Nineveh Plain Protection Units, NPU, linked to ADM, got coalition support, integrated into Iraqi forces. Then the Nineveh Plain Forces, NPF, linked to a KDP-aligned party. And Nineveh Plains Guards, NPG, seen as a direct KDP proxy.
This fragmented security creates tensions.
Definitely. Assyrian groups, especially NPU-ADM aligned, report obstruction, intimidation from KRG forces, checkpoints, accusations against KRG Aseish security of arbitrary arrest, torture, suppressing dissent, targeting Assyrians critical of KRG or land issues.
Multiple armed groups mean instability, hindering returns.
Yes. Assyrians often feel caught between Baghdad and Erbil. Interestingly, NPU-secured towns seem to have higher Assyrian return rates post-ISIS than KRG-controlled areas, suggesting more community trust there.
Land rights and disputes seem like a really persistent, damaging issue, intensified under the KRG.
Reports suggest so, yes. Both within a KRI proper, like Dohuk, and disputed Nineveh Plain. Numerous reports from Assyrian groups, API, ACE, NGOs, leaders document illegal seizures of Assyrian villages, farmland, property by Kurdish individuals, tribes, figures allegedly linked to ruling parties.
API documented over 130 cases in KRI.
Yes. And the allegation is often that KRG authorities, Peshmergaseish, facilitate this by failing to stop seizures or enforce evictions. Assyrians often call it Kurdification, aimed at dispossessing them, changing demographics.
And legal redress is futile, even with deeds or court orders.
Consistently reported as unenforced if the land grabber is politically connected. Points to a breakdown in rule of law impunity. It extends beyond farmland to church properties, too. HRW also documented KRG forces destroying non-Kurdish homes post-ISIS beyond combat damage.
What about cultural and educational rights in the KRG? Formally, Syriac is recognized. There are Syriac schools.
Formally, yes. KRG Constitution recognizes Syriac where spoken, state-funded Syriac schools exist, around 56 reported in 2019. KRG education reforms aimed at rights, equity.
But Assyrian communities report challenges.
Significant ones. Accusations of Assyrian history heritage being marginalized or appropriated in the KRG narrative, ancient sites claimed as Kurdish, Assyrian history neglected, reported changing of place names to Kurdish, discrimination against Assyrian kids in schools, limited jobs, contributing to emigration.
Lack of basic infrastructure in Assyrian villages.
Also reported schools, healthcare, roads, utilities. While religious freedom is generally better than federal Iraq, church property confiscation and societal discrimination remain concerns.
So a major gap between formal rights and lived experience.
That discrepancy is key.
Yeah.
KRG has inclusion mechanisms, but persistent allegations on political manipulation, land grabs with impunity, security abuses, cultural marginalization. They suggest serious shortcomings in governance and minority rights protection.
Okay, let's turn to Northeast Syria, Rojava, now the Autonomous Administration of North and East Syria,
yeah.
Azantis. The Syrian war created a power vacuum there.
Allowed the PYD, linked to PKK, and its armed wings, YPG-UAPJ, to establish autonomy. Initially, Rojava expanded post-ISIS, formalized as Eiris in 2018, seven regions.
And it's based on democratic confederalism. Well,
yes. Ekelon's philosophy, inspired by Bookchin, an alternative to the nation-state, decentralized democracy, secularism, ecology, gender equality, 50% quota co-leadership, protecting all ethnic religious groups.
The social contract explicitly lists Arabs, Kurds, Syriac, Assyrians, Turkmen, Armenians.
Yes. Chechens, Muslims, Christians, Yazidis. A commitment to multi-ethnicity on paper.
What's the Assyrian-Syriac role and representation been like? Sounds like they participate, but with divisions and tensions.
Exactly. Politically, you have the Syriac Union Party, SUP, an early key partner aligned with PYD's Daranoi ideology. Contrast that with the older Assyrian Democratic Organization, ADO, historically part of the Syrian opposition, initially neutral, then joined the Syrian National Coalition.
So ADO has a more complex relationship with ADS-PYD. Critical, but engaging.
Yes, sometimes U.S.-mediated dialogue. But interesting that both ADO and SUP issued a joint statement in a hypothetical 2025 scenario post-Assad fall, calling for an inclusive, decentralized, secular, democratic Syria with constitutional recognition for Syriac Syrians. Language, representation rights.
What about military and security forces?
The Syriac Military Council, MFS, SUP's wing, formed 2013, founding SDF component in 2015, fought ISIS heavily, has a women's unit, HSNB, then the SUTORO, Assyrian Syriac Police in Christian areas of Jazeera. Split later, one faction aligned with Assad, SUTORO GPF, another integrated with A-list security, ASAESH, working with MFS, and the Kabur Guards, local militia, later disbanded.
Despite the inclusive ideology, there are governance issues and tensions, concerns about PYD dominance.
Significant concerns from observers and some groups. Turkey sees it all as a PKK front. This dominance led to marginalizing rival Kurdish groups like KNC, arrests, exclusion.
Strained relations with Arab populations too. Deir Ezzor, Raqqa.
Yes, incorporated post-ISIS. Arab tribes protested alleged discrimination, resource issues, oil, heavy-handed security. Clashes with SDF in 2023. Amenis tries decentralization, but ISIS insurgency complicates things.
And Assyrian-Syriac communities have faced friction. The school closure incident in 2018.
That was prominent. Forced closure of private Assyrian schools run by the Syriac Orthodox Church for refusing the new Aenis curriculum, seen by some as Kurdish nationalist, and preferring the Syrian Gov curriculum plus Syriac religious instruction.
Aenis cited lack of registration, unapproved curriculum, used SUTORO to enforce.
Yes. Sparked protests, condemnation from ADO, international groups as an attack on cultural autonomy imposing PYD ideology. A later agreement reportedly allowed reopening, but it highlighted tensions over education, minority rights.
Other grievances, looting reports, preventing ADO leader entry, concerns about Kurdification like in KRG.
Those have also been reported. Broader concerns about authoritarian practices mirroring some KRG issues.
What do human rights reports say about Aenis territories generally?
HRW, Amnesty, U.S. State Dep document concerns, arbitrary arrest detentions, political opponents, due process violations, disappearance killings, suppressing dissent, child soldier recruitment by YPGA-SAESH, despite rules against it, excessive force documented, Amuda 2013. Detention conditions for ISIS suspects families raised, and the devastating impact of conflict, especially Turkish operations.
So a tension between progressive ideals and the messy reality of governing in conflict.
Absolutely. Amnesty offers unprecedented formal recognition participation for Syriac Assyrians, but concerns about Kurdish dominance, authoritarian practices, policy clashes, schools, human rights violations, it shows ongoing challenges. The relationship is a work in progress, cooperation and friction coexist.
Looking back at this huge sweep of history, from ancient times to now, these patterns really stand out in the Kurdish-Assyrian relationship.
They do. Recurring themes of conflict, recurring themes of cooperation, all shaped by internal dynamics, state policies, regional geopolitics. Understanding them is key.
Let's recap those recurring themes of conflict.
Okay. One, land and resource competition. Ancient pastoral rights, 19th century Hamidi grabs, contemporary Kurdification allegations in KRG disputed areas. Kirkuk, Nineveh Plain are flashpoints.
Two, political dominance versus autonomy. Ottomans using Kurds against Assyrians, post-WWI Assyrian anxieties, current concerns about genuine representation in KRG and as quota manipulation, PYD dominance, clashes over Assyrian local autonomy demands versus Kurdish regional goals.
Three, historical grievances, contested narratives, the shadow of the Seyfo, the Deir Khan massacres. A Syrian collective memory emphasizing Kurdish participation fosters mistrust. Denial hinders reconciliation.
4. Security dilemmas, mistrust. One group's security measures seen as a threat by the other. British levies, Peshmerga expansion, KRG security actions. Volatile environments with rival security actors feed this.
And 5. Instrumentalization by external powers. Ottomans, British, Baathists exploiting tensions. Today, regional powers like Turkey and Iran impact minorities caught in the middle of Kurdish movements.
But there are also recurring themes of cooperation.
Yes. 1. Shared minority status, joint advocacy. Finding common cause against oppression. League of Nations petitions, opposition movements. The 1919 Kurdo-Armenian Accord showed potential.
2. Alliances against common enemies. Assyrian groups with Kurdish parties against Saddam and the IKF. Shared ideologies, secularism, leftism, sometimes helped. Controversially, some Assyrian groups reportedly cooperated with PKK against Turkey.
3. Joint security efforts, tactical or structural. MFS and the SDF, NPU cooperation with Peshmerga Iraqi forces, even historical precedents in Hakkari.
4. Formal recognition and cultural initiatives, though limited.
Right. Recent formal recognition of Assyrian identity, some cultural rights by KRG, constitution, schools, Kurdish municipalities in Turkey publishing in Aramaic, ANS adopting Syriac, but implementation and sincerity are often questioned due to contradictory actions.
So, analyzing these patterns, conflict seems worse during state formation transformation, when competition intensifies, or when states manipulate relations, clashes of competing nationalisms.
Exactly. Cooperation seems more likely against huge external threats out of military necessity or shared ideology, but often tactical, fragile alliances.
And there's a persistent asymmetry. Kurds often setting the agenda due to size movements, Assyrians reacting, negotiating their space.
That's a constant feature. It shapes the dynamics, often leaves Assyrians vulnerable, facing difficult choices.
So to wrap up our deep dive, a long history, conflict and cooperation intertwined. Competition over land power, historical trauma, external manipulation fuel conflict, shared minority status, common enemies drive cooperation, an asymmetric relationship.
And the contemporary picture differs. KRG faces criticism on implementing rights, land issues. ANS, despite inclusive ideals, struggles with genuine power sharing, protecting rights in practice.
We didn't get specific recommendations from the sources, but based on patterns for KRG Iraq, address land disputes fairly, reform representation, ensure equitable resources, support local security, promote inclusive education.
For NSSDF, strengthen multi-ethnic governance, protect cultural autonomy, uphold human rights, foster trust, international community, monitor rights, condition aid, facilitate dialogue, support transitional justice, NGO civil society, document, support culture, promote dialogue.
Yeah, those seem like crucial areas. Ultimately, this deep dive really shows how deeply historical events and power imbalances impact groups trying to coexist.
It absolutely does. Navigating coexistence in diverse societies is incredibly complex.
And on that note, a final thought for everyone listening. Reflect on how these dynamics between two ancient peoples mirror broader challenges, the impact of history, power imbalances. What lessons can we take from their complex story conflict, cooperation, trust building, external interference that might apply elsewhere today? Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.